The railroad made America a nation. Before the railroad, a trip of less than 200 miles, say, would have been very taxing physically. It would have been time-consuming. It would not be the kind of thing that one might do for fun. But after the railroad came and tracks crisscrossed the nation, a passage across the country could be undertaken with relative ease, depending on one's means. You could even do it in substantial luxury. The railroad helped to create a national economy. It built the great interior cities of the country, like Chicago. It helped to settle what was the Wild West. It even gave us standard time. This morning, in this part of Focus, this first part of Focus, we're going to dip into this history a little bit, see if we can give you an appreciation for the role of the railroad in American life. Our guest is George Douglas. He's a professor of English here at the U of I. He teaches American literature and also nonfiction writing, and is the author of a recent book entitled All Aboard, The Railroad in American Life, which is published by Paragon House, and it is a history of the development of the American Railroad. A social history, really, because it concentrates on the way the railroad changed the country. And I just thought I would read a couple of lines from the introduction because I think it's a nice way to start. He writes in the introduction to the book, "Deep down, most Americans still believe the railroad made us the people we are. It gave us our desire for movement and escape to some other place. It gave birth to our sense of the diversity of places, of cities, of suburbs, of leisured resorts." Further, he goes on to say that all previous forms of human endeavor had enslaved people, had kept them wedded to toil. But the railroad always represented the opposite. It was a form of energy suited to the appetites and dreams of a democratic people. George Douglas is here joining us in the studio this morning. Thanks very much for coming over to talk with us.
Good to be here, David.
We appreciate it. And for people who are listening, if you have questions, comments, you can give us a call as well. 333-9455 is our local number. Toll free, 800-222-9455. It says on the jacket for your of your book that you have been a railroad buff since childhood. What are some of your early memories of trains? What was it that caught your interest?
Well, of course, you know, I have the luxury of being born in the days when the steam locomotive was still operating, and I sometimes feel sorry for the young of today who only are familiar with the diesel engine, but there was something about the steam engine which was definitely romantic, I guess you might say, because, well, they called it the Iron Horse, and a horse is a living, breathing creature. And so I think somehow or other that there was a degree of romanticism still left in the railroad when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Although it was soon to pass by, of course.
Well, you know, as I was thinking about it, I wondered whether it wouldn't be true that for perhaps at that time when there were still steam locomotives, it very likely would have been the biggest man-made thing anybody would have seen, if you discount perhaps a large building.
Yes,
but in terms of a machine, nothing else could rival it for size and power and maybe even complexity.
No, that's right. And when the railroad first made its appearance in the 1830s in the United States, there were some people who just well, there were people who were terrorized by it, and there were other people who couldn't believe it. When the Camden and Amboy Railroad started in New Jersey, which was the first regularly scheduled railroad in the United States to run on a daily basis, the first train that was set out there that hundreds of people came, many of them believing that this beast, this monster, could never turn a wheel. You know, they just scoffed at the idea. And when it did, and sparks flew, and everything, people and chickens and dogs and things ran off in all different directions. You know, so. So it was yes, at that time it was considered a remarkable thing, you know, just the way maybe we regard the space program in the 60s.
Yeah. To appreciate how the railroad changed things, one has to start out and at least think a little bit about how difficult travel would have been in the early days of America. And I think you put it nicely where one point you write that at that time travel was so difficult that for all intents and purposes, the 13 colonies were like 13 separate countries. And it stayed that way for a long time. And you think, well, you know, there were roads and people could ride horses and there were things that were like stagecoaches. But traveling was really very difficult. It was really hard. And it was just not a thing that people did unless they absolutely had to.
No, that's right. I started out the book with a little vignette there of what it was like to travel between New York and Philadelphia in 1820. And at that time, well, you know, today New York and Philadelphia are only about 90 miles apart, so travel between them is very quick today. But in 1820, it took two boat trips and a very difficult stagecoach ride over poor roads. There was no such thing in 1820 as a paved road. I mean, it just didn't exist anywhere. In fact, when the railroads came in, the roads that were being built, a lot of them were not continued or not finished or something like that. So that we didn't have in the United States any paved roads outside of big cities until 1908, when Detroit built Woodward Avenue a mile out of Detroit, you know, because they were an automobile town. So until the early years of the 20th century, the railroad was the infrastructure of the United States. I mean, it was everything where transportation was concerned.
I suppose if you talk about the pioneers of railroading in the world, they probably were the British.
That's right. The British had, of course, horse railroads in the coal mining areas for several hundred years before the steam engine came along. So they were used to the business of having a track, which is a device for pulling loads under reduced friction. And then, of course, they were building the first steam locomotives, and they were almost all of them in the very early years used in those same coal mining areas.
Mm-hmm. So the first locomotives to come here to the United States were made in Britain. I think even the rails were made in Britain.
And it was specifically also for pulling these heavy coal loads. The first locomotive, to put in practical use was on the Delaware and Hudson, and that was to pull, you know, very heavy coal loads out of the coal mines there.
Who was it here in the United States that first started thinking about using it as a way of moving people?
I think probably that credit ought to really go to Colonel John Stevens, who in Hoboken, New Jersey, whose name today is remembered because of the Stevens Institute of Technology. But he had published papers on this subject for a long time. And in as early as 1825, he had built a little experimental railroad on a circular track in Hoboken. But for a long time, he was just considered to be a visionary or a quack, and people didn't pay too much attention to him. But then around 1830, then there was a tremendous burst of activity of interest in railroads. Hmm.
This fellow, Colonel Stevens, apparently had really left his stamp on the railroading for a long time. One might even say, in a way, to the present day, because this apparently was the man who developed the rail, what is very like the rail we use today, the sort of T-shaped rail. He was also the man who developed the spike. That had that little hook at the top to hold the rails down, and pretty much the sort of the pattern of the rail as it looks, the way it was fastened down to the ties and everything was pretty much this guy's.
He and his son established the Camden and Amboy Railroad, which was an attempt to link New York and Philadelphia, or to get rid of the stagecoach part of the trip, you know. And so a lot of the developments, their first locomotive, of course, was imported from England, but then they had a number of others that they built themselves, and there was a fellow who worked for them, Isaac Dripps, who was a mechanic, and when the first locomotive came over from England, he had the job of putting it together, and he'd never seen a locomotive before. But he had worked on some kind of engines, I guess. So he put this thing together, and he was responsible for some other early technological oddities and developments, such as the development of the cow catcher and things of that sort.
Indeed. Well, let me just reintroduce. We're talking this morning with George Douglas. He's a professor of English here at the U of I and is the author of a very delightful book that just recently come out, which is A History of the Railroad in American Life. And the book is entitled All Aboard, and it's published by Paragon House. And if you have questions or want to get in on the conversation, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. This railroad, the Camden and Amboy, which was the first real rail line in the sense that we think about it today, made it possible to go from New York to Philadelphia in 7 hours. Although I guess you had to do some of that by water. You couldn't actually get on the train in New York.
That's right. In the early days, you had to. Part of it was by water, but then within a few years, of course, they had the whole thing.
Yeah. And they started out in 1832, and by 1849, which they considered a big year for them, they carried 136 people. So it was still sort of the demand in the building in the beginning,
right,
was still sort of slow.
Yeah. The 1830s was very primitive railroading, of course, but in the 40s and 50s, there was a big upsurge of it.
Well, we talked about the difficulty of travel and how the coming of the railroad changed things a lot, but I guess also one has to appreciate how in the early years of rail travel that it was not particularly comfortable. And it was even rather dangerous, and I really enjoyed the one detail you included, that apparently in the early days in some of the tickets there was a clause that said if there was a derailment that the passengers were required to help put the train back on the rails again.
Right, and of course the thing is that the equipment was very lightweight in those days. I mean, compared to what it is now today, you couldn't get a group of 30 people together and lift a train back on the track. But you know, these were diminutive engines in those times, and I mean, if anybody's ever seen those, and they have been on exhibit in World's Fairs and things like that, they look just like little toys compared to the equipment that. That we know in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. Well, was it just how safe or how unsafe was railroading in that early time? What sort of hazards were people exposed to?
In the very early years, there were a lot of troubles with not only derailments because the track was poor, but things would stick up from the floor of the coach, and sometimes in the very early times when the coaches were still open, ladies' dresses would catch on fire because the sparks from the locomotive would fly back and things of that sort. You know.
Mm. One of the things that's sort of striking is how fast railroads did catch on and how fast track was laid. Because at one point I think you explained that say in 1840 in the United States there were only something like 3,300 miles of track, but by 1860, by around the time of the Civil War, it was up to like 30,000 miles of track. So it happened very, you know, over those decades, a lot of track was laid and a lot of new railroads were started.
That's right, and in fact, by the Civil War, the North already had what you would call trunk line railroads in operation, and this in effect made the North a national economy. Now, the South by the 1860 still had no trunk line railroads to speak of. They were really sort of all local carriers still. But the trunk line railroads enabled the country to have a nationwide economic system, you might say, or so that people could order manufactured goods from Connecticut out in Chicago and that sort of thing, which previously wasn't possible.
Mm-hmm. And certainly that must have proved a very important advantage for the North in the Civil War, because they had that infrastructure. The Southern railroads were not developed to that extent. And also, they really didn't. Most of the locomotives and most of the rails were made in the North, too. So,
practically all. In fact, the South, when the Civil War broke out, had only one factory that was manufactured locomotives or rails, and that was the Tredegar Iron Works in Richmond, and that they immediately had to convert to making shell billets and things of that sort. So they had no capacity to build, and the experience of the South during the Civil War was they had to cannibalize the lines that they had, and so toward the end of the war they were in pretty bad shape as far as being able to transport things around.
We were talking before about some of the hazards of rail travel, and I guess in the beginning, even the cars were open. They were not much more than a flatbed with seats on them. Eventually, and I guess it didn't take too long, the cars were enclosed, and once we get into sort of the 1880s and 90s. There were some very, very luxurious ways of traveling that we can talk about.
That's right.
But very quickly, the passenger coach, as we know it today, as this long car with an aisle down the middle and rows of seats, pretty much mm-hmm. became the standard. And it's interesting to think about that and contrast that with European railway coaches, and which people will be familiar with either by going there or seeing them in movies.
That's right.
As being a very different sort of affair.
In the 19th century, most continental European trains had separate carriages. There might be one coach on two sets of wheels, but basically people entered them from the side, and this was to keep the social order separate, in society. If you had first-class people, they didn't want to hobnob with other people. In fact, it was, a social indiscretion for a duke to have to sit with a coal miner or something like that. Whereas in more democratic America, people mingled more freely, and therefore the open coach in which you could walk up and down the aisles, and then eventually after the Civil War, go between the coaches. There was a long time before the Civil War when you couldn't go from coach to coach because it was too dangerous to do it, and there was no vestibules. And so that was considered a major advance when they put in these vestibules. And then you could walk the whole length of the train. And, of course, that also led to such things as the invention of the dining car, because as long as you couldn't go between cars, there was no sense having a dining car. But almost in the early days, almost all the eating that was done on the train, would come to a stop at some station which had an eatery or a dining room, and would wait there for half an hour. People would eat and then go on. But when the dining car came in, of course, this led to much greater speeds. On a run between New York and Chicago, you could greatly increase the running times. And, of course, the coming of the Pullman car after the Civil War also led to the, train travel becoming very luxurious, as well.
There are some stories in there about how it was sometimes a difficult business when the train stopped, having to get off to eat. If there was some restaurant or some railroad eatery there by the tracks, everybody would pile off. Everybody would try to get served. Some of the people couldn't, and apparently there were some engineers who took great delight in sneaking out, especially if they had a lot of foreigners on the train, leaving people in this place where they were trying to eat.
That's right. Sometimes in the West, this was a freaking form of maliciousness on the parts of the crews. They would go, and then 10 minutes later, without calling, train about ready to leave, they would just signal a start, and the train would go off, and big bunch of immigrants. In those days, there were a lot of immigrant coaches on trains and special fares for them and things like that. And a lot of them, by the way, had been arranged by the railroads who had agents in European countries, you know, to settle their territories, you know. Both the Illinois Central and the Burlington all had big colonization efforts because they built these railroads into nowhere, so they had to have people come out there. And so it was a big enterprise. But pretty often, yes, as you say, those immigrant trains weren't always the best in the world, and sometimes people had to stay on them for days without being able to get adequate food and water. And sometimes the thing that you mentioned happened, the train would pull out, and then those people would have to wait there another day until the next train.
Yeah. We have somebody to talk to here. Let's do that on our toll-free line.
Yes,
hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
The hazards of railroading. They used wood logs in the original ones, and they had mechanical brakes that were very dangerous. They couldn't stop the train until Westinghouse came out with the air brake. And one of the
Yes. The thing that you mentioned about the dangers in the early years of before the air brake and the coupling, yes, both of those things were major sources of danger. And the railroads were had a lot of problems in the early days like that. They, for example, it took them a long time to discover that you could control the movement of trains by means of a telegraph, and so when they were just operating on the timetable and they had no signaling systems, there were a lot of terrible crashes in the early years and things like that. And also, in the early years, the Americans had built they had larger locomotives than the British had, more powerful and more dangerous. And the British thought the Americans were crazy for building these.
Well, especially the mountain trains. Some of those wheels were about 6 or 7 foot high, and every wheel was a pulling wheel, where they would take timber and cattle and things through the mountains.
Right.
Enormous trains. I mean, they were probably 3 or 4 times as big as the trains that were in the East and in the Midwest.
Yes, and I think very often, you know, for a long time at least in the 19th century, some of the loads that were carried and things were considered to be dangerous by rail experts from other countries, and no doubt they were.
They also set a lot of fires at wheat fields and corn fields and timber, and then they put the spark arrestor on. It was a sort of a screen that they put on the stacks.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you're talking about the ladies' garments got on fire. That was caused from wood.
That's right.
Sparks.
Yeah. I guess we didn't mention that earlier, but yes, in the first few decades of railroading, most of the locomotives were wood burning, and the coal came in.
Well, wood was plentiful wherever they went. That
That's
was
right.
one reason
That's
for
right.
it.
That's right.
Thank you.
Cut down an awful lot of forests, unfortunately.
We, you know, still, I think on train crews today, they have men whose official title is brakeman. Mm-hmm. I don't know what brakemen do today, but but the brakemen, they were the guys that did have these jobs to couple and uncouple the cars. And I guess in the very early days, there was a brakeman for every car, and they had to sit outside.
Yes, it was a miserable job, but they had to sit on the roof, and there was a big wheel there to turn. And when it was ready to stop, the engineer would give a down brake signal on the whistle, and then all the brakemen would turn these things. So yes, that was an absolutely terrible job. On the other hand, the brakeman was a kind of an interesting character in American history and folklore, because you know, there was always something very romantic about brakeman for some reason. Other. He was a heroic character to young ladies and the popular imagination and dime novels and that sort of thing. You know.
Well, this morning on our program, we're talking about the railroad and its place in American history. And our guest is George Douglas. He's a professor of English here at the U of I and is the author of a recently published book entitled All Aboard, The Railroad in American Life. And it's published by Paragon House. And if you have questions for us, you can give us a call. I guess one of the things we've touched on that we owe to the railroad is the settling of a lot of the United States. The early railroad builders did something that I suppose some people thought was strange. That is, rather than building railroads going to places where people were, they built lines going to places where people weren't. And for that reason, people flowed where the lines went.
Right. That's The West particularly was really colonized by the major lines that went there, and many of the major cities and towns of states like Iowa, Nebraska, and so on were formed along the line of the railroad that went out that way. And very often, the first settlement there was just some something built lumber that was thrown off the back of a train, and that became that became a municipality. But yes, the English were particularly contemptuous of the American way of building railroad lines to nowhere. I think it was some Englishman who said, "Well, these Americans will build a railroad from nowhere, in particular to nowhere at all." And and there was this habit of taking some little town in Ohio and saying, "Well, we'll call this the Ashtabula and Western, you know." They had Western, and it sounds like it's going a long way, even though the railroad only goes 5 miles, you know. And it was an era of boosterism in the United States when everybody wanted to have a railroad, and they wanted to have a college, and even though the college was only a one-room schoolhouse, they'd call it a college, and so they had railroads that went a few miles. But the fact is that the builders were right, that eventually these railroads did settle those territories, and they did become big industries, mm-hmm. you know.
That's something that I guess I didn't know or didn't fully appreciate. You know, I guess you think about a railroad settling the West, but it also had a very important part in settling the Middle West. And in fact, there are a lot of communities mm-hmm. here in central part sure. of Illinois that really were settled also because of railroad. And probably, Champaign, I guess, would be one of them.
Yes, Champaign was definitely a railroad town. In fact, there really was no Champaign when the railroad first came down this way. There was an Urbana, but the Urbana City Fathers didn't want to have anything to do with the railroad. They didn't want the railroad coming smoking up nice, peaceful Urbana. So the railroad went a few miles west in a place that was then called West Urbana and put the railroad station up there, and later it became Champaign.
We have a couple of other callers here to talk with. Let's do that. Line one. What's next?
Is it true that some executives in the past used to have their own railroad cars in which they practically live and even kept cows? And the second question, is it true today that railroad crews do their day's work by traveling 100 miles and still draw $50,000, $60,000 a year in wages?
Okay, well, those are two separate questions. The first one is rather interesting. All railroad executives in the major days of railroading had private cars. In fact, not only the president of the line, but usually the superintendent of the division had a private car. And of course, as you know, there were many private citizens who had private cars. Now, this question that you asked about cows traveling with them, I have heard that Jay Gould, who was one of the great railroad buccaneers of the 19th century, he often traveled in a private train, and he had a car which carried a cow because he had an ulcer, and he wanted the milk from that very car to take care of his ulcer. But I don't think that was exactly what you would call a regular thing, but there were plenty of private. And in fact, there are still a lot of private cars in operation, and there's an association of private car owners, and they have conventions every year, and so there are still quite a number of private cars in existence. But as to the other question that you raised, about the wages of railroad employees, one of the things that's happened in the last few years is that the work rules have changed greatly. The crew numbers, the reason the railroads are prospering right now, or one of the main reasons, is because a lot of these old labor problems have been settled. They have sometimes two men crews, and union employees are generally, still fairly highly paid. But on a lot of regional carriers and certain lines, the operating crews aren't unionized. So that there's quite a diversity, at the present time.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. To another caller, line four, our toll-free line.
Hello.
Yes, hello.
I find this program interesting because I've been a railroad buff all my life. There's one thing, I believe about a month or so ago you had a Mr. Joseph Rennick on the program who was talking about super trains.
I think he was on the afternoon
okay.
Magazine. But yeah, I remember hearing that, yeah.
I wanted to hear ask the professor if he feels that there's going to be an opportunity for us to develop a system of super trains in the United States because passengers, it's a proven fact with Amtrak that passengers are going to flock to trains that are well-run and operated and provide adequate transportation across the country. And what he sees as the prospects for the super trains as Dr. or Mr. Rennick.
Right. The type of thing that's presently planned for Texas, for example. Yes, I think there is a future in these things. And, you know, Amtrak, of course, has had its most success with the high-speed Eastern Corridor between Boston and New York and Washington. That's their biggest success story. And my feeling all along, of course, Amtrak labors under a tremendous amount of difficulties. You know, it has to operate a lot of the country under rail that's only suited for freight traffic. And of course, there are a lot of other problems too. But they really do a fairly good job considering the difficulties they work under. But I think there are a lot of opportunities for so-called corridor service for railroads that would really be a better idea than air traffic. For example, you know, Amtrak hasn't done as good in operating corridor services between, say, Chicago and Milwaukee, which is a natural, or even Chicago and Indianapolis, or Chicago and Detroit. Now, if you had high-speed trains running those routes, they would be able to really to whip the airlines, because why should a person go out, want to go between Chicago and Detroit, and it take them an hour to get out in the airport on beat-up highways in both places when they could get there in the train in a few hours, you know? So that there are really great possibilities there. It's just that I think it'll be a good number of years before all these things materialize.
I have to agree with you. You mentioned the Texas system. I understand that a president of a Texas airline or an airline that's based down in Texas is fighting that project hand, tooth, and nail.
No doubt.
But that's another right. thing was, when you mentioned England and its attitude toward American railroads, I was fortunate enough to travel in England, and the place is rather small. You know, I don't think the British really appreciate what vast spaces we had over here. They did like to invest in them. I think some of them took a financial bath when they did try to invest in some of these projects that didn't get off the ground.
Yes, that's right. Well, a lot of the financing of American railroads in the second half of the 19th century was by British capital. And, of course, when they did discover to their chagrin that the system was over here was somewhat overbuilt, and that was one of the things that caused the panic and the depression of 1893 when a lot of railroads got into serious trouble and a lot of British financiers got skinned.
Thank you very much, sir. Enjoy the broadcast.
Okay, well, thanks for the call. Let's talk with somebody else. Line number two. Hello.
Yes. I'm from the East Coast and Philadelphia area, and I know that, or at least I've heard, that the main line, which is very familiar and very wealthy neighborhood,
sure.
Philadelphia, was named, or the stops along the main line were named by a railroad individual. Now, a couple of years ago, I was in Oklahoma City and noticed, looking at a road map, that there were towns with the same names heading south along the railroad line out of Oklahoma City. Okay. I was wondering, what is the Pennsylvania Railroad tie-in to this area?
In Oklahoma?
Yeah.
That's a good question, and I'm afraid I don't know the answer. What you said about the Philadelphia Main Line, some of the towns, not all of them, were named by executives of the railroad, and that was considered to be a prerogative of the railroad executives in the early days to put down a station. They could name it whatever they wanted, and very often the towns that grew up from that would take that name, you know. But
I understand they had a real thing for English names like Haverford and Bryn Mawr,
right,
and Radnor, and places
right,
like that.
Right, that's right. Yeah, they did. Uh-huh.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
Oh, that's something that leads me into one of the areas that I want to ask you about. Something else that I learned and I guess didn't know was how great a part railroads played in developing of suburbs. And there's a chapter in Chicago where you discover that, in fact, people were commuting to work in Chicago by train as early as the 1850s. And that some of the places now that you know are familiar names around Chicago, sure. Hyde Park, for example.
That's right. It was way out of Chicago at that time.
Now
it's of course right in the middle of Chicago, but in
those places
days,
like
it was
Kenwood,
right.
Oakwood, right. Those right. kinds of places were railroad right. stops and. In some cases, I don't know if they were were those places also named by the railroad?
Well, of course, Hyde Park was already that name already existed. That was the first suburban train that the Illinois Central put on in the 1850s, and then they extended it somewhat down to these other neighborhoods. Now, I think there was a there were some people who lived down there who it seems to me, as I recall now, I'd have to go back into this, but I forgot. I think Kenwood was there was a doctor who lived down in that neighborhood who came from Scotland, and I think he picked that name as a from his ancestral home. But the thing was that sometimes the railroads quite often would use the name that had already been selected for a place. But on the other hand, quite often they'd change the names and then the community would go along. Or sometimes it would resist. You know, there were a lot of different patterns of that.
We just have about 10 minutes left. Let me just again mention our guest. He is George Douglas. He's professor of English here at the U of I. We're talking about the railroads in American life. He's written a book entitled All Aboard, which looks at the social history of the American Railroad. It's published by Paragon House, if you'd like to take a look at it. We do have a couple of other callers here to talk with, so let's do that. And I think line 3 is our next person. Hello.
Hello. I was wondering about... in the beginning of the auto industry, to what extent was railroad lines bought up? And I was wondering if you could discuss some of the details and politics involved with that.
Well, I'm not sure. What do you mean, railroad lines bought up?
I guess I've heard these sort of rumors that in the beginning of the auto days that auto companies bought up railroad lines to sort of ensure that people would drive their cars places.
Oh, I see. No, I don't think that was true. I think the railroads were still very powerful in the early days. I think it was, if anything, it was just the opposite. That when trucks first started to come in, and there were some state roads, there was some consideration that the railroads would take over the trucking industry. But no, I think what in the period before, say, World War I, the railroad industry was so immense and so powerful that none of the automobile companies would have been able to buy. Or what happened there, though? You're right in one extent, was that when the roads got better, as they did very quickly in the 1920s, a lot of railroad branch lines got lopped off very quickly. And that was what led to the decline of passenger service. You see, there was a time when there were 140,000 railroad stations in the United States, many of them on small lines that only had way trains or something like that. But when people started going short distances by automobile in the 20s, then a lot of these lines started to wither away and the stations were closed up and things like that. And as a result, it is true, we gradually lost passenger service, which was a real shame because at that time, we had an infrastructure of public transportation that covered the whole country, and now we don't have anything like that because 140,000 train stations, that was a tremendous number. The airlines only go to about a few thousand places, and the Greyhound bus lines, which are in have problems of their own. They've cut off more and more small communities. So we don't have adequate ground transportation at the present time unless you want to go by automobile. But certain older people can't do that and single mothers with children and so on and so forth. So the kind of infrastructure that we had as late as, say, 1930 in the United States is just something that isn't duplicated today, unfortunately.
Now, didn't city planners have to choose between building new roads and sticking with the railroads in existence?
Well, it all depends on what time frame you're talking about. I think the big
the time you're talking about in the late 20s when they started to decline.
Yeah, well, at that particular time, there was a big impetus toward roads because of the building of automobiles. But actually, it wasn't until the interstate highway system came along under the Eisenhower administration in the 50s that railroad passenger service really completely fell apart because, you know, they were, as late as 1950, they were still hoping, the railroads were still hoping to maintain really good passenger service. But as soon as the... Well, just to give you an example, in upstate New York, when the New York State Thruway was open, all the local trains that the New York Central had up there between New York and Syracuse or Utica and stuff, they almost were all discontinued within a few years because people wouldn't go those distances except by car, you know. But now we've learned to regret that in a way because a lot of people don't want to go by car.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. I think it is true, isn't it, that there were some instances where people who made cars and tires did try to go after urban mass transit.
Yes, that's a very good point, yes. Now, on that, this is what happened in Los Angeles, because Los Angeles had this wonderful system of interurbans, and the tire people and automobile people attacked that viciously, which was really a dumb thing. It was very dumb of Los Angeles to let that happen, because now they've had to spend billions of dollars to put that stuff back in operation, whereas they had, out in Los Angeles, they had a good system of light rail, interurban type stuff, and 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And so now they've got to put it back in.
Let's talk with someone else. The toll free line. Hello.
Yes, I had an uncle-in-law that used to be, conductor or something, on the trolley out in Los Angeles. No, for professor of English, I'm kind of surprised that all of this, you've overlooked or neglected sort of the literature part of railroads. It's all been commercial and mechanical. I'll just go down a few things and then...
I have a chapter on that in my book. We just didn't get to discuss it.
Well, I'll go down a few things here and then let you... The time's running late. So, one, the use of the train as sexual metaphor. That's quite common. Another thing is the disappearance of the romantic possibilities of both the cross-country train trip and the transatlantic ocean trip. I mean, not complete disappearance, but to a great extent. Hobos after World War I. And then also two other things, but the train was, I think, unique. One earlier call mentioned the clickety-clack, the rhythm of a train and the nighttime whistle.
Yes, those are all good points. I think I've covered a good number of them in the book, in some of the later chapters. You're talking about the rhythm, of course. That's why the railroad has been so There's so many popular songs, and it continues even after passenger services declined in country and western music for there to be a lot of train songs and of all different types, ballads and that kind of thing. And as far as things like hobos go, yes, this was hobos grew out of the nature of railroad work, in which up until the Depression years, there were a lot of itinerant railroad workers who would go from one railroad to another, and sometimes these people were, if they were full-time employees, they were usually called boomers, and that is those people who really wanted to work, but they shifted around from different parts of the country. But when they fell down the social ladder and they didn't work very hard or really were just traveling, they often called them hobos, and sometimes there were bums and tramps. And a lot of them sought to ride free on the railroad, and of course this was a big problem for the railroads up until through the Depression years, you know, and then after that it subsided a lot.
We're going to have to stop, I'm sorry to say. And I would suggest to people, if you'd like to read more, and especially in some of the areas that we did not touch on in the interview, the things that the last caller raised, those are also in the book, some discussion of the railroads in popular culture and literature and music and so forth. So there are a lot of other things in the book. If you're interested in trains, you might want to take a look at it. All Aboard is the title, The Railroad in American Life by George Douglas. Thanks very much.
Thank you.